Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
From the Kia Studios, inside Midtown Atlanta, Will Polacek here with you. It is Sports Radio 92.9 The Game, 92.9thegame.com, and the radio.com app. Hope you're enjoying yourself as this Monday morning begins. And it begins off of a Sunday evening that Atlanta fans in the sports world can be proud of. A 7-1 victory by the Atlanta Braves over the Washington Nationals, maintaining the same lead that they had going into their series with Washington at 6.5 games, and the Atlanta United beating DC United 2-0, which vaults Atlanta United into a second-place seat right behind the Philadelphia Union, 3 points out of first, 1 point in front of DC, leapfrogging them in the Eastern Conference table and setting up a juicy matchup on Friday night with LAFC. We'll give you a full recap of all that here in just a moment. We're also going to talk about 16 minutes from now with Mike Griffith, Atlanta Journal-Constitution and Dog Nation. He was at SEC Media Days getting you ready for Georgia football camp, which gets underway here pretty soon. And also, don't forget, today is the day. Atlanta Falcons training camp begins. I will rerun through for you the five keys that I had for a Falcons playoff run this year and also get you ready for training camp, which opens later on today in Flowery Branch. And I'll also give you why I think that college football has lost or is in the process of losing the general public with comments that came from a very prominent head coach earlier this week. But first, to the Braves, who beat the Nationals 7-1 in an unlikely performance from Kevin Gausman. Look, I think if you could have given possibly the way that this looked, I thought a lot of people would have thought, okay, you know, maybe he goes out there and throws six innings. Maybe he gives up two or three runs. Maybe he gives you a quality start. That'd be, I think, the baseline for a lot of people's expectations for Gausman off of this plantar fasciitis injury. Well, he did you not only better than that, but he did you one better as opposed to basically what he brought to you on the mound. He was sensational. Seven basically scoreless innings. A run came in that he basically left in the responsibility of Anthony Swarzak, who he allowed to score as an inherited runner. But mostly a seven-inning scoreless outing for Gausman. Five hits allowed. He struck out eight and looked every bit the part of somebody who could be a contributor for the Atlanta Braves come the stretch drive of this season. Ronald Acuña Jr. hit his 24th home run of the season, also scored another run based off of a very crazy run around the bases. He tripped over third base but came to his feet and was still able to get himself upright enough to get himself home for the run to score. 2-for-4 day for him, 2 runs scored, 2 driven in, a walk, 2 Ks. Freddie Freeman had 3 hits, 2 runs scored as well, a run batted in. He also contributed to the defensive prowess as well. Josh Donaldson had 2 hits, including his 23rd home run off of Ross, who gets the loss for Washington, sitting now 6.5 back of Atlanta. And what do we learn about the Braves? Well, we learned that they can at least hold serve at home against probably one of the hottest teams in the National League. Let's be real. The Nationals have won on basically an 800-900 clip over the last month or so. And that was the first time that they had a loss for a starting pitcher in their last 17 contests. So their only losses have come basically by virtue of their blow-it bullpen. That's the other thing, too, that I worry about, too, when I think about the Atlanta Braves. Atlanta Braves fans have it in for their bullpen, and I understand a lot of it centered around Luke Jackson. But you could have things a lot worse. Look at Washington's pen. Washington's pen has the very awesome prospect that come out of here that pitches for them very so often. It's called Gasoline on a Fire. Highly touted prospect out of the Nationals bullpen. He comes in and things blow up. That's basically what they look like on a semi-nightly basis. Ask any Washington Nationals fan what they think about their bullpen, and they'll say, the Braves, you have no idea what you're looking at when you think this is a bad bullpen. And granted, the Braves have their errors when it comes to the bullpen. I will give you that. There are times where I look at A.J. Minter on the mound and I say, why? There are times I look at Luke Jackson on the mound and I say, really? Again? But as our Joe Patrick pointed out to me on this very radio show a couple of hours ago when we had him on, our Braves reporter on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game, if you're going to fill one need during the July 31st trade deadline, which is 9 days away, that need has to be a starting pitcher and not someone out of the bullpen.
They've always needed help in with their starting rotation over a bullpen. I just think it's like, I think prioritizing the bullpen over the starting rotation is kind of like putting the cart before the horse, you know?
Right.
Like it's just more important to have guys that can get you to the closer than to get a closer and not have him be able to affect the game at all.
That is Joe Patrick earlier tonight right here on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game, our Braves reporter. And to me, it's more about getting to Luke Jackson. See, if you get to Luke Jackson with a lead, then you know, basically anybody you put in there is going to be basically on even odds. And the other part of this, too, is that there's not the kind of closer out there that was out there, say, a couple of years ago when Aroldis Chapman was being dangled by the Yankees and it was basically for the highest bidder and the Cubs went out and got him and won a World Series with him. You're not showing me that closer right there on the market. It's not Will Smith. It's not Shane Green. Andrew Miller's not walking through that door. So because of that, I'm not willing to give up high-level prospects for somebody who brings you about the same odds that Luke Jackson brings you. Not to say that Luke Jackson's not supposed to be the guy, but if you really don't necessarily want him, then maybe give Swarzak the ball, maybe give Newcomb the ball. Or maybe just do a closer by committee. I don't know. But you're not bringing in a life-changing closer to this system with what's available on the market because too many teams right now see themselves as buyers. It is not a seller's market. I mean, it is a seller's market in the fact that the teams that are selling are going to get a lion's share back. The problem is what they have to offer in terms of bullpen help does not inspire me. And as a result, shouldn't inspire the Braves to make that kind of a bold move. Atlanta off tomorrow, or I should say later today. They play Tuesday, Wednesday against Kansas City before hitting the road to see Philadelphia and Washington again in the NL East. Again, 6.5 game lead on Washington at the start of play to begin the week. Atlanta United, a 2-0 victory over DC United today, and it was interesting to see this game develop because it had all the makings of a playoff-type atmosphere at Mercedes-Benz Stadium earlier Sunday, and because of that, it caused both teams to look tight at times, and that tightness produced some very high-scoring chances. I think from the way that DC United tried to play things, they did as much of the clogging in the middle and packing it in and almost allowing Atlanta United to take possession as much as possible. They very much wanted to clog the passing lanes and allow nothing really to develop and get all their chances off the counter. And trust me, they had a couple of golden chances, a couple of saves that needed to be made by Brad Guzan that were of the high caliber quality. But they finally broke through on a moment that can only be described as redemption for PT Martinez. Martinez gets the header goal set up on a beautiful play by Heineman and Joseph Martinez, and I think possibly puts to bed the just complete drama that has surrounded this player over the course of the last 2 weeks. Julian Gressel, who also had a fantastic game as well when it comes to the United, talked about the kind of get-off-the-schneid game that it was for PT Martinez.
He can be just as big as Nuge was, you know, I think, and be a big star. So, yeah, like I said, he's just going to have to keep working and, you know, working within the team, getting adjusted to things. And then I'm sure we'll see what he can really do, or everybody can really see what he can really do.
That is Julian Gressel, who, it's funny, in that game basically was relegated to a wing position that I think he is more suited for in the Atlanta United starting 11. He had some real killer crosses that led to some very high-level scoring chances for United. They weren't ultimately realized, but you saw the inspiration in Frank de Boer's tactical moves today that caused United to look more in form offensively than they have in quite a while. That goal by Martinez, the aforementioned goal, set up again by the great play by Emerson Heineman, who has been a godsend for them in the middle. Joseph Martinez able to get a little bit more spacing after Martinez entered and Brandon Vasquez exited after 60 uninspiring minutes trying to play up forward with Martinez. And PT comes in and replaces Brandon Vasquez and gives Joseph a lot more room to operate. And as a result, they get the opener goal. Joseph ends up on a counterattack, getting himself a very nice chance to get a chip over the goalkeeper for DC United and redeem him his own self after a biff of a penalty shot earlier in the second half that looked very much at the time like Atlanta United's best chance to possibly get their opening goal. But because of the fact that they got the goal from PT Martinez, they relaxed themselves a bit, got a goal off the counter, a 2-0 victory, and gobble up all the 3 points, vaulting into second place in the Eastern Conference. Three behind Philadelphia, who sits with 39 points. They now have 36. They're one ahead of DC United, and it sets up a matchup of epic proportions on Friday night against LAFC, which the captain, Brad Guzan, says they will try to keep a level head about, but it'll be difficult.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's going to be an exciting game. They're a good team. Obviously, they're coming off of the game against the Galaxy. So it's going to be, you know, I'm sure you guys on the outside of the locker rooms will hype it up as much as you can. And us as players know that it's a big game, but it's not the end-all, be-all. It's a chance for us to continue to pick up points and keep this, you know, this short run of games going in a positive direction.
That is Brad Guzan, the captain of Atlanta United. Atlanta and LAFC, Friday night from Bank of California Stadium, the first trip Atlanta United makes to LAFC's new digs. Pre-game 9:30, kickoff 10 o'clock Friday, and that is here on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. Shane Lowry wins the Open Championship. I will say that when you think about this, you have to be happy for him in the singular moment. And I do think that we at least need to give him his due. It was an inspiring performance, even though it lacked drama. And it lacked the kind of picturesque golf that I think a lot of people like me want to see more of. But those who are the purists who like the Lynx style of play, we at least give him a portion of the Open to honor him for that. And that's about it for him. Because that's about all I can offer on the Lynx golf. Sports Radio 92.9 The Game at 92.9thegame.com. When we return, we're going to talk a little Georgia football. Mike Griffith, who covers the Georgia Bulldogs for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and Dog Nation, I will ask him if the window is closing for the Georgia Bulldogs coming up this season with a third year under Jake Fromm, a fourth year of Kirby Smart. Is this Georgia's best chance to get that elusive college football playoff championship? Will Pelagic here with you next on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game and 92.9thegame.com. It is Sports Radio 92.9 The Game and 92.9thegame.com. Let's head to the WadeFord.com hotline, and we are joined by Mike Griffith, of course, who covers the Georgia Bulldogs for Dog Nation and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Of course, media days were this week from the SEC in Hoover, Alabama. And Mike, you know, from the standpoint of Georgia, I think they kind of walked in this week with a little bit of bravado. I think that, you know, they kind of believe that their season is pretty much set right in front of them. Aside from what will happen in the first weekend in December, it all seems kind of it will go according to Hoyle. How did you at least come away with not only the way that Georgia sounded, but I guess the correct word would be performed in their visit to Hoover this week?
I think there was a quiet confidence. I think you could tell that Georgia was confident. They were very careful not to talk about any games beyond Vanderbilt. Obviously, they knew coming in they were going to be asked a lot about Alabama, having led or been tied 281 out of 290 slaps the last 2 years and not won. They certainly realized that people were going to question what was going to happen against Alabama this year, and if they could get over the hump, if there was some psychological hump. So they knew they would get a lot of questions on that.
It's obvious to me that Alabama kind of looms in the minds of a lot of people as still the top team in this conference, but I almost feel like Georgia kind of gets an unfair moniker against them because, people will say Alabama and Clemson are 1-2, and they forget that Georgia basically over the last couple of years has had to play a de facto conference semifinal or even a quarterfinal, depending on how you look at it, and a lot of times that could be a knockout game. To me, I almost feel like that SEC championship game is almost just as tough as those semifinals that are played in the last week in December or first week in January.
Well, I'd say history has indicated that, recently for sure. If you look back to last year, I think Alabama was up on Oklahoma 28-0, 17 minutes into that football game, right? And then the year before, both Alabama didn't even play in the SEC championship and was able to win a national title, just to tell you about the depth of the league. So I think that's a fair point. And, I think if you look over at the ACC and everyone's starting to call it the All Clemson Conference, right? That's
right.
What ACC stands for. And I think that's fair. On Friday, the preseason All-SEC team came out. There were 11 Alabama players that were first team, only four from Georgia. And you say, geez, I didn't think the teams were separated by that much. But maybe that's the way the voters in Alabama at the media days felt.
Dog Nation's Mike Griffith joining us here to talk a little Georgia football with us on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game on the WadeForward.com hotline. Is fall camp getting underway here pretty soon, Mike? And I know that while the recruiting rankings have certainly propped up Georgia over the last couple of years and Kirby Smart has brought them to the forefront, it almost kind of feels like this is the best opportunity in this current window with a rising junior in Jake Fromm and all the skill position players that come along with it, the upper-class talent. Does it feel like this is the win-at-all-cost type year for Georgia?
Well, I don't know about win-at-all-cost. Every year they want to win at all costs. But
true.
I don't think it should do anything to the coach's job security or anybody to re-examine the program if, Georgia, were to fall short of winning a national championship. I do think that they should win the East. It's possible that they lose a game or two, or it's possible that another team gets really hot. Georgia does have some pretty difficult crossover games against Auburn and Texas A&M, and, those teams could have something to say about it. And we all know not everybody plays the same schedule, so I guess it depends on how good Texas A&M and Auburn are and if they're a threat. But to your point, I think that the window is closing short-term because there does appear to be a large group of underclassmen who could go pro after this season, including Jake Fromm, as well as three or four of those offensive linemen. So, then you wonder, how much of a championship contender could Georgia be next season if Jake Fromm doesn't come back and, no real star heir apparent waiting in the wings at this time. And so I think that's kind of where we see that sense of urgency.
It's interesting. You looked at all the skill position players that were coming back, and obviously Swift was part of that. And then, of course, Holloman, with his departure, kind of leaves a bit of a hole in the wide receiver room. How does Georgia compensate with that? Do they have the weapons to be able to give Jake Fromm enough to work with?
I think there's talent there. There's no question losing J.J. Holloman hurts. There's just no way around it. Even if you've recruited it well, even if you feel good about Demetrius Robertson and Lawrence Cager and Simmons, Matt Landers, even if you feel good about all those guys, the bottom line is you lost probably your best receiver, and to the dismissal a couple of weeks ago. That hurts, no question. You lost Isaac Nada going pro early. You lost Mecole Hardman going pro early. You lost Riley Ridley going pro early. It's hard to win championships when your guys don't stick around. One of the keys to Clemson winning a championship last year was, their defensive linemen came back for their senior year, and that was enough to get Clemson over the hump. And, you look at Georgia right now, and suddenly, as you said, that receiving core looks depleted. And while I think there's talent there, the question is how quickly can they get in sync with Jake Fromm? And we know they work out a lot during the summer, and they'll have a very strong fall camp. Kirby works his guys very hard in the heat in the afternoons and does a lot of scrimmage action, as much as is allowed by the NCAA. And yet still it's not the same as doing it in front of 92,000 at Sanford Stadium. So there are questions there. I think that's fair, and I think that's going to be something to watch as the season progresses, because you know, once you get past Notre Dame and you get that bye week before the Tennessee game, you know, things start to really pick up for Georgia schedule-wise in October.
Mike Griffith, Dog Nation, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, covering the Bulldogs, joining us here on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game with me, Will Pelagic. I've heard a lot of people say that this is the best offensive line that Georgia's had, if not ever, in quite some time. And I know that evaluating that, especially subjectively as it is before the season, is hard to do, especially when all you have to go off is on paper. But how would you assess the statements of the nature of this offensive line for the Bulldogs?
Well, I think it's potentially the best offensive line that I've seen since I've started covering SEC football in 1993. And I saw a pretty good offensive line at Auburn in 93 when they went 11-0. I know they weren't on TV, so a lot of people didn't get to see it because they were on probation and banned from TV. But that was a pretty good group with Wayne Gandy and Free Willie Anderson, as they called him, Free Willie back then. You know, and then I covered the 1998 Tennessee Vols. And, you know, that was Chad Clifton and Cozy Coleman. And those were some pretty special future NFL stars, too. And, you know, Michigan State, a Rose Bowl team, had Jack Conklin anchor in the left line. And you know, Allen at center, Jack Allen. And so I've seen some pretty good offensive lines. But from a depth standpoint, I don't think I've seen anything like this. And from a physical standpoint, I certainly haven't. These guys average 330, and, you know, they're all in great shape. You know, they're not the – you don't see the gut hanging over the belt here. I mean, these are all big athletic men that move really well. Sam Pittman's coached them up in an outstanding fashion. Now, all that said, they've got plenty of motivation because they got handled by Texas in the Sugar Bowl. You know, and some people could say that it had to do with their lack of effort, that they weren't as prepared as they needed to be. You know, Andrew Thomas was talking to me about that. They accept responsibility. Kirby pointed out that Texas had 8 or 9 seniors on defense and wanted to make a statement and played the game a different way than Georgia did. But that's on Georgia. There's no apology. You don't get an okay for that. So if they want to be, if they want to live up to this Great Wall nickname, then they're going to need to show how they respond from getting handled by Texas in the Sugar Bowl, because their last outing was probably their worst of last season.
Yeah, no, it's weird. A lot of those guys on that line are from the 16 and 17 recruiting classes, and just at recruiting, covering recruiting as closely as I did over the last couple of years, it seemed like a lot of those guys were offensive linemen. A lot of those guys were in, you know, recruiting battles with, you know, either border states or other in-state schools, and it just seemed like every time Georgia had a battle on a kid, they got him, and they were able to transform their roster in a way that's hard to at least see over the course of the last couple of years for anybody doing that. What did they do differently, and not only just from what they've done differently, how are they getting this different kind of player now in these battles?
Well, people, you know, these players love Sam Pittman. They love playing for him. They believe in his development. You look at the players that he's put into the NFL. You know, Kirby gives him latitude. You know, it's a great scenario. I mean, there's a lineage now, and if you're an offensive lineman, you know that if you come to Georgia that you could be selected in the first round and that you're going to compete. You're going to be surrounded by other great players. And, you know, there was a time when, and there's still some players that feel like they want to play right away. But I think players are starting to get a little bit more savvy now. They're starting to realize, you know what, it's okay if I don't play my first year. It's okay if I don't start till my second or third year, because really, why are you going to Georgia? Well, yes, it's a top 15 public institution. There's no doubt the academics here are as good as anywhere in the league, or really the country for that matter. But a lot of these guys want to play in the NFL. And so if you're coming to Georgia because you want to play in the NFL, well, you're playing for a coach that can develop you that way. You're working out with other guys that are going to play in the NFL. They're going to push you to become better. So, you know, it's kind of like the RBU thing, right? You know, if you play for Kirby Smart, he's going to have a downhill run game, and you don't mind throwing carries because, we've seen Georgia, I believe they're the first program in history to have back-to-back seasons with two 1,000-yard rushers that were all different guys, four different guys. You had Chubb and Michelle in 2017, and last year you had Holyfield Swift. Now, I don't think we're going to see that trend continue. I think Swift's going to be one of the 1,000-yard rushers this year. We'll see if Harrion can get there, if Zamir White or James Cook steps up. But, getting back to your question, I think Sam Pittman is and Kirby Smart, they've started something special. And these linemen enjoy being a part of what Georgia does in that offensive line room.
The easy answer seems like Florida, but I'll ask the question anyway. Which game scares you the most on Georgia's schedule?
Well, I would not say Florida. I think there's a couple of unknowns. I mentioned them early in our interview. We don't know much about Texas A&M and Auburn. Auburn's been a pain for Georgia. A very good Auburn football team. I thought Georgia in 20, and I still think this, Georgia was the best team in college football in 2017. They were the best team in college football in 2017. Alabama, did not even win their own division. I'm still not sure, how they got in the playoff, but they were one of the four best, I guess. But, of course, last year, the four best didn't matter. You had to win your league. They keep, as Kirby said, they keep changing it every year in that room. We don't know what parameters or what rules the committee is going to decide on. I guess we'll have to ask the Oklahoma and Ohio State ADs that were in the room when they were talking about Georgia last year what happened. But, to your point, I think Florida will be good. Dan Mullen has got a great track record at Mississippi State. I know a lot of fans on Twitter like to, make fun of them and ridicule them. And, I saw the same thing happen with Butch Jones. Look, those are good offensive football coaches. Butch Jones set a single-season offense record at Tennessee, beat Peyton Manning and David Cutcliffe's single-season record. Dan Mullen has coached up some pretty good quarterbacks and done some pretty impressive things with lesser talent at Mississippi State. And Florida finished last year with a lot of momentum, the way they handled Florida State and Michigan. So I do think Florida will be a good football team. But, Jimbo Fisher is a guy that, if I'm an opponent, he scares me a little bit. I mean, this guy knows how to win now. I mean, Jimbo knows how to win. And A&M's got some players. And I would say the same thing about Gus Malzahn. He's taking over that offense again. And Kirby said it last year. You play a Gus Malzahn team, you spend the first quarter just trying to survive and figure it out. So, and you're at Auburn, okay? And A&M is late in the season. So a tough placement for that game. And I'll tell you another one. Missouri. Yeah, look, the whole East. The East had a winning record against the West last year. They were 9-6 against West teams last year. And that's counting Alabama's win over Georgia in the SEC title game. So the East has kind of beefed up a little bit. Missouri is a team with Kelly Bryant. And, that game last year in Columbia was a dogfight. That was not an easy football game for Georgia. Missouri brings back has really good line play. Barry Odom's shown what he can do coaching defense. And I think Kelly Bryant has a chance to be an X factor there. Derek Dooley's done a pretty nice job of that offense. So, yes, it's true. Georgia has won every SEC game by double digits, SEC East game by double digits the last 2 years. But I do not expect that trend to continue, and I think the Bulldogs are going to be challenged.
You can find his stuff on the Atlantic Journal-Constitution and on the Dog Nation portal there. Mike Griffith joining us here covering the Georgia Bulldogs. Thanks so much for the time, Mike, and hope you packed your sunblock for Athens.
No doubt about it, Will. Thank you.
That is Mike Griffith here on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. We're long due for a break. I will ask the question, is college football losing its base? And if it is, I offer my hypothesis why. But a prominent college football coach offers an alternate one. Comes your way next on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. It is Sports Radio 92.9 The Game and 92.9thegame.com. Nicely played by producer Greg Patton. So we dovetail our college football discussion with Mike Griffith into this that basically comes across with me. Look, I grew up in a place that did not have the kind of college football that we have here. I went to a college that was probably more known for football over its history than anything. Probably football, basketball, both equally, equal parts both. I'd say football more so now because of their transition to the SEC at Missouri. Wouldn't say it was a powerhouse by any means, but you get the idea. I was indoctrinated into college football by that. and obviously through my career have covered very many college football games now beyond that of the NFL, and I grew to love the sport, but I do believe that it is losing ground and losing traction in our American sports consciousness. Over the now 5-year history of the college football playoff, we've had 9 different teams, only 9 over the first 5 years, get into the playoff. Oregon, Florida State, Ohio State, Alabama, Clemson, Oklahoma, Michigan State, Washington, and Notre Dame, and Georgia. That's it. And as a result, college football has created its own inner bubble, and that bubble almost seems impenetrable. You have 3 teams in Alabama, Clemson, and Georgia that many believe this season, before they even take the field, are odds on locks to make the college football playoff this year, which leaves up for grabs maybe 1 spot. And who does that go to? Ohio State, Michigan, Oklahoma? And not even outside of that. Maybe you have 8 to 10 teams at all who feel like they have a spot or at least an opportunity to compete for a spot in the college football playoff in any given year. There are 130 teams in college football. Don't give me the baloney that a bowl game means as much now as it does then, because it's completely devalued. All the bowl game is a commercial for ESPN now and an opportunity for your kids to go get a shopping spree at a mall that hopefully they don't mess up and turn into an off-the-field distraction and violation. This is not 1980. 6 wins for a bowl is way too much. It's become so glorified and unnecessary that I look at it in the postseason and I wonder, you know what? I'm not surprised that some of these players are skipping these bowl games, because it's not worth it to me if I'm somebody who's going to be making money at the next level to actually be somebody who is actually playing in these games. The games that are more important to me are the ones that are being played at the next level. What's more important to me is the combine and the pro day and senior day and the senior bowl and things of that nature. So from my perspective, sorry, I'm not playing in the Gasparilla Bowl or the Independence Bowl. See you later. I believe the college football playoff has ruined college football. Call me a cynic. Call me somebody who is looking up their nose at something that we all seem to already want. And it's not that I thought that the BCS was much better. But tell me this. While the BCS did get it wrong a couple of years, all the argument and the belly aching that we seem to have about who's number 5, those arguments seem to outweigh any arguments we had over who's number 3 in the BCS era. And despite less teams getting a shot at the title, there was a clearly defined way to get yourself in to the BCS top 2. And while we all know who the blue bloods are in this era of college football, it seems harder to penetrate that bubble now than it ever did during the BCS era, when you had teams like USC and Miami having their heyday, when you had teams like Nebraska having their heyday in the pre-BCS era, when you had Michigan looking nice, you had all these different teams. Granted, It's not as if we had a much greater scenario, because we all knew who the blue bloods in college football were. But now it seems like it is impossible, unless you run the table in a Power 5 conference, to get yourself in amongst college football's elite and to sustain a program is even harder to do in this day and age because of what's going on with the transfer portal. And college football attendance has taken a downturn because I think a lot of these teams just don't feel like they have a shot and they feel like they're disqualified before they even kick the ball off. Now, Northwestern head coach Pat Fitzgerald has a different theory of why we've seen the interest, at least in attendance when it comes to college football, decline. He provides this interesting hypothesis.
I think that's just it's just changed the way a lot of younger people and younger fans intake is all through technology. And I mean, you watch a concert and everybody's holding their phone up like, listen, watch, take it in, create a memory, because they don't go back and watch the videos. They just want to post it on their social media, which is pathetic because it creates a society of, look at me, isn't my life great? Even though when they go home, they're like, I hate myself, I hate my life, everything's wrong. So I think it's a big cause. I think it's the root cause, number one. You know, I think the fans that grew up going and tailgating and the fans that grew up going to the stadiums 4 hours before the games are getting a little older. And I think the next and younger generation of fans are more reliant on technology. They'd rather have 12 TVs set up in their TV watching cave than go to a game and experience the pageantry and the tailgating. So I think it's definitely things that we need to look at as a brand, college football, on how we can maybe create that type of environment and experience while respecting our communities and our neighborhoods to make sure the experiences that are happening don't impede on those neighborhoods.
That is Pat Fitzgerald, the head coach at Northwestern, who, interestingly enough, had his team potentially one win away from a college football playoff berth, although I don't know if they would have gotten the berth if they would have won the Big 12 outright, because it probably would have been somebody else who felt that they held a stake in that, but a chance to at least get to a pretty prominent bowl, end up playing in the Holiday Bowl last year and beating Utah. But still, winning 9 games at Northwestern, you know, while they can see that as progress, that is a far cry from what I think we're trying to accomplish with this sport. You cannot give the illusion that every team has a fair chance to get in this thing. And I'm not trying to sit here and say that we need the NCAA tournament to infiltrate college football. And I don't want to create a layer of regurgitating expansion that eventually gets us to that point. But the committee and the folks who are in charge of it need to pick a number and need to pick out parameters that make it more available. The scarcity model does not work here when it comes to the economics of it. I know people will try to look at this and say the scarcity model works. It does not work when it comes to college football, because you are taking a heavily regionalized product and making it even more so to the point where it's exclusionary. The college football playoff shouldn't be reserved for just the Southeast and just the lower Midwest or Texas. The upper Midwest, the West Coast, the Northeast need representation in college football's premier playoff event. As much as I want to see just the top 8 teams in the SEC battle it out for a potential college football playoff, it's getting awful boring sitting here and seeing the same 4 or 5 teams every year get together and play in these games. Not that I don't want to see Alabama, Clemson 5. But at least let them go through a gauntlet that gets you more and more like an actual playoff and not just this rudimentary exercise that we have now. What was left on the cutting room floor when we come back as we wrap up a Sunday into Monday edition of Will Polonchuk here with you on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game and 92.9thegame.com.
Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. The official start of the football season.
We will have full coverage of the beginning of training camp in Flowery Branch beginning 4 hours from now with John and Hugh right here on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game and 92.9thegame.com. Falcons reported on Sunday. First practice is today. John and Hugh will be there getting you ready for it all. beginning at 6 a.m. Left on the cutting room floor tonight, Trae Young went off in the Drew League, 31 points, 12 assists. Yay. Rose Lavelle from the U.S. Women's National Team met her namesake. Literally another young lady who was named Rose Lavelle. The reaction was priceless. And apparently Tiger and Rory are going to play a skins game event in Japan. Probably be more actually compelling to me than the actual Open Championship. Man, I just love to rail on Lynx golf, apparently. All right, thanks to Greg Patton, who did a fantastic job over the last two nights. I love working with him. It was fantastic. I hope you enjoyed it as well. Our thanks also to Joe Patrick, David Hale, for joining us on the program tonight. Coming up next, CBS Sports Network, Amy Lawrence will take you through the rest of the evening. And again, Falcons training camp, all the rest of the recap as well from the Braves' victory over the Nationals and also Atlanta United's victory over DC United. Should be a fun Monday of sports to talk about here with you. And hope I enjoyed, at least got it started well enough for you. Will Pelagic saying, so long, Atlanta. You're listening to Sports Radio 92.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.